It's been proven to be true, like one and one are two. It's checked and double checked, a fact that can be backed. Because it is a scientific fact. It's a scientific fact that there are belts of radiation in outer space which are a hazard for future space flyers to overcome. It's a scientific fact.
A scientific fact.
God told me to sacrifice wife and children. A man sentenced to 90 years in prison for attempting to set his Orlando home on fire with his family sleeping inside said God commanded him to sacrifice his wife and children, according to a local Six News report. Hans Misal, 51, admitted to dousing his Orlando home with gasoline last March. Misal also duct-taped the door shut and ran a hose from the house to a car tailpipe while his wife, son, and daughter slept before he attempted to set the structure on fire. Tuesday, Misal said he was following God's orders. Misal compared himself to the Bible's Abraham, who was commanded by God to sacrifice his own son, and said he received a message from God to kill his entire family. Local Six said. And this is the Hellbound Alley program.
That's exactly what they
said. And this is Frank. And this,
yes.
And this is Ed Grieve.
Hello.
Hello, Edouard.
Hello, Francois.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing just great. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're fine. We're fine. However, we are preparing to move.
Yeah.
Preparing to move?
Operation is going to pick up and move elsewhere.
Yeah. We're not sure where yet, but we're thinking about Granby right now. It's a little city south of Montreal.
Anyway, while we're in the process of moving, we don't know quite yet, but there could be some disruptions in your service.
In your Hellbound Alley service.
Not really disruptions in your service. There may be a drop show. I don't know yet.
We'll see. What we can scrape up in the meanwhile.
But everything will be back to normal soon enough.
It's going to be a little iffy is what we're saying for a few weeks. So we're going to try to do our best to
Make everything the same for your comfort.
Seamless, that's what it's all about.
But I doubt it'll be completely seamless. At least there might be a little different atmosphere. There might be a little bit different equipment, a little bit different sound.
No.
Anyway, so this Abraham, this modern Abraham.
Well,
yeah, I really like that that intro. That was pretty interesting there.
Well, here's my question to the Christians now. They don't take these kinds of things seriously, but they take Abraham seriously in the Bible. Now, here's my question. How do you differentiate? How do you know? How do you know that this guy did not, in fact, hear God in his head telling him to sacrifice his wife and children?
Absolutely.
Well, because God wouldn't tell you to do that, yeah? God
told Abraham to do it. This is really interesting because actually, the Abraham story, I think, is something really hard for clergymen and people who are leaders in the Christian community now. It's not as hard for fundies. I'm sure Pat Robertson has no problem with it, but are you going to hear Pat Robertson talking about this guy? Probably not.
Well, my question is,
if you do, he'll just say, well, he wasn't a true Christian, end of story.
The guy, after he tried to kill his family and everything, when they went in, did they find sheep in the beds? That's what I want to know. Because...
Well, see, now, if somebody wants to sit there and say, oh, well, you know, he's obviously crazy, he's not responsible.
How
because,
do you know that?
But what did he do? He duct-taped the doors and he put a hose from his car. Come on. I mean, that takes a little bit of thinking and planning.
Yeah, but how do you know? I mean, I suppose a Christian could say that he's schizophrenic or something, but how would you know the difference?
How do you know? Because, like a couple of Christians have told us, Ray Comfort and Matt Slick have both told us that they were communicated to by God. What's
exactly.
the difference between the still small voice that came to you and the still small voice that came to him? When we ask you, how do you know it's not Satan, or how do you know it's not your own troubles, they just say, well, we just know. This guy just knew. Obviously. He knew so well, he knew so completely that he did this. This takes knowledge. Not that I'm saying he actually knew for sure that God really said, but he thought he knew, or he wouldn't have gone that far, unless this is an elaborate farce.
Well, we're going to talk today about the refutation of God belief with science. But this is another major area, which is the information problem. Because if you accept the existence of a God that can basically do anything, and other assorted mythical beings that have great powers over you, well, how do you know anything if you accept that premise? How can you know anything?
This is kind of interesting.
That's a really basic problem that Christians can't address at all. They just assume, they say, well, the Bible is true. You say, well, wait a second, you accepted that God could be tricking you into believing that the Bible is true.
And
yeah, but
God
would do that. How do you know that?
What about Pharaoh?
How do you know that God does? Yeah, God actually does attack people's free will in the Bible. So it's kind of a self-refutation.
I was thinking this reminded me of a recent Rational Response Squad show. They talked to a guy who thinks he's Jesus. And I went to this guy's MySpace webpage. And his favorite movie in the whole world is, guess what? What the Bleep Do We Know? Well, now, that movie we know comes from the Ramtha people. Out in Yelm, Washington, the ones who channel, you know, 10-trillion-year-old philosophers.
Well,
and, he believes, this guy believes that we can't know anything, which is kind of what that movie was saying while using, you know, retarded quantum physics for, you know, personal love life stuff. And, but, you know, he believes that nobody can trust their brains, so... I guess he doesn't care if we don't think he can trust his brain either.
Exactly. Their strategy is the way they cope with that epistemic anxiety is they say, well, look, we don't know anything, therefore my wacko theory might as well be true.
I'm not really sure how that convinces us of somebody's position.
Well, but of course the problem is it doesn't escape the anxiety. It's just another weirdo position that is under the same problem, under the same basic problem of information. It's like Christians who use nihilism in order to say, look, we can't really know anything by science and sense perception, therefore you should trust the Bible. Question, how do I know about the Bible? Answer, sense perception.
Exactly.
Therefore, I can't trust the Bible.
Because God...
Once you accept the premise of nihilism, that's it.
Right. The Bible, either you read it and that you get it through your senses, or God sends you something through your senses.
You cannot weasel out of it.
Way to perceive... I mean... We know you're not actually perceiving, you know, the Lord talking through your brain.
That's an elephant.
But, you know, either you invented it completely or you got it through your senses. I'm not really sure what they're trying to say, that some sort of magic was absorbed through your skin and you knew it. You know, that's kind of like the Sumum religion where they say you can drink this wine and automatically know the principles of our religion, which is, I guess you could call it a sense perception. Information
yes,
that has gotten through the stomach. I don't know.
It's complete perception, yeah. Perception, definitely. I don't know how it's supposed to work exactly. You think they would try to win the $1 million prize for that?
Well, you know, they make all their money through their sarcophagi.
Sarcophagi.
Which they haven't made one yet.
Sarcophagi?
They make dog sarcophagi, but they make these really huge, elaborate $75,000 sarcophagi for people, but the first person that has it on his plan hasn't died yet, so we have yet to see what they're going to produce. Sorry, tangent.
No, it's okay. So, how about that? So we have decided that there's no way for Christians to refute that story, right?
I don't see how.
Yeah.
By just denying it, by saying, well, it's all about belief anyway, blah, 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 blah.
His belief
is just as valid then, right?
Talking about belief, why don't you read us the current state of the war in Iraq clock?
I'll try. It's going up $2 a second. Anyway, the war in Iraq.
No, it's a little more than that a second. It's about $2,000-$3,000 a second.
Oh, sorry. So $282,178,210,000.
215,000,
220,000, 230,000, yeah, it's going up as we speak, 240,000, yeah. So, yeah, I'm sure you guys, you Americans are real happy about that. Congratulations.
And why are we mentioning the war in Iraq clock? Very simple. There's sometime in the coming week, the number of American soldiers killed in the Iraq and Afghan wars will exceed the 2,752 people who died in or around the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. So, congratulations, you have created a second World Trade Center fall.
Great.
Isn't that wonderful?
Fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous.
So you see, that's the spirit. When terrorists kill you, don't give up. Kill yourself some more.
Mm-hmm.
That's the American spirit. Never give up. Never give up. Never surrender.
Oh, instant message. Sorry. So. Sorry about that.
So our topic today with Ed is refuting theism with science. And that's good because Ed is a scientist.
That sounds like a pretty good topic.
So we've got a scientist to talk about science. See that's how smart we are here. If we're going to talk about science, we get a scientist.
Because science is our religion and we worship it.
That's how you do it.
It's called dogmatism.
Yeah, absolutely. We worship science. I have a big logo of an atom.
True. You can ask Ken Hovind to tell you all about how much we worship science.
Ken Hovind says that
we worship time.
We worship time.
Oh, right. Time,
because,
right.
Because you know it takes billions of years for evolution to work.
So. Yeah.
Well, anything can happen in billions of years.
Great God, time. Actually, somebody else already worships time. It was like the Greeks or something. What was it? The god with the
Kronos.
Yeah. But that's like what Father Death or something is based on. So actually, it's the Christians who sort of worship time when you think about it, because they worship death.
So Ed, there's been a lot of squabbling by the intelligent design movement.
Yeah.
To try to redefine the method of science.
I would say it's mostly just squabbling and that's about it. There's really nothing there. Yeah, I mean, you know, they try to redefine the science, like you say, and the scientific method, but any reasonable scientist won't even bother listening to them because it's all just BS.
Maybe so, but there are a lot of people who are, even though they are for evolution, who are very sympathetic to such attempts because they see the notion of naturalism as being a limitation upon our inquiry in the world. Well, that's why I would like to talk for a minute about how science works
Yeah, right.
And most specifically, how falsification gets into that. Can you explain that in a short way, how the notion of falsification is essential to science?
Right. Well, in most sciences, you predict something's going to happen, or you have an idea that something's going to happen, and it doesn't really matter how you get that idea, but it's not true yet. It's not a theory. It's nothing. It's just your idea. And then you go and check, because that's what science is about. You go check experimentally, empirically, you observe whether or not what you're guessing actually happens. And if it doesn't, then it's basically falsified your guess. It's basically falsified what you thought would happen. And that same falsification applies to even the most rigorous scientific theory. If you go out and try to check a theory like relativity or quantum mechanics, and you end up not observing what the theory predicts or observing something that's incompatible with the theory, you falsified it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the main things, one of the most important things about the scientific method is that there is that aspect of falsification. For instance, in religion, there is no falsification.
Mm-hmm.
If you say something and you believe it with faith, it's true, guaranteed. There's no way to falsify that. You can argue with a religious person until you die, until the day you die, and you can use strict logic and everything else, and you'll never be able to falsify their belief, because religion is unfalsifiable in that sense, and it can't lead to progress.
But
that's what's so great about science.
You know why? That there's a way to falsify religion.
How's that?
You have a war between one sect and the other, and
okay,
and whoever's left is right.
That's a good point.
Because God,
yeah, God's on their side,
them.
Right?
That's your
point. You just give it to the football team, and whoever wins, apparently, you know.
It's the Mormons.
It's the Mormons versus the Calvin.
That would be interesting.
That might be a way to solve some of these problems.
Yeah. So, but the problem, here's the problem. Falsification demands that there's a causal connection between the object and yourself, correct?
Okay.
Because if there's no causal connection between the object and yourself, then you cannot observe any effect of the object.
Right.
For example, in here I'm referring to the so-called immaterial. For example, if there's a God, well, either it acts on the universe or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then there's no way to falsify it. Therefore, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a belief. You can't verify it in any way whatsoever. You can't see anything about it. So falsification implies naturalism. It implies materialism. Because if you try to consider a supernatural explanation, well, the supernatural explanation is not falsifiable. At best, what you can falsify is its supposed effects. But I don't think there's any way to connect such natural effects to a supernatural cause. I think that's quite logically impossible. I don't know if you agree with me on that.
Yeah, I probably would.
To be able to say that there's a connection to something supernatural, you'd have to disprove any possible naturalistic explanation a priori.
Right.
I don't think that's scientific.
Well, it would be pretty hard, but I guess not impossible to do. If you examined, you know, every location of every atom in the universe and looked at their wave functions, I guess it would be.
I suppose if you did have knowledge of the entire universe.
But in that case, wouldn't that let you be able to sort of predict the supernatural effect and turn it from a supernatural effect into a natural effect? Or cause?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. I suppose if you really could not have any explanation for it, I don't know, you could simply say, but then couldn't you simply say that it's uncaused?
That it's uncaused?
Yeah. Because the problem comes in the connection between a natural event and a supernatural explanation. The problem I see is there's no way to get from one to the other.
Right.
If you're going to use any logic in this. Anyway, I don't know. It's like, even if you knew everything and you saw this so-called supernatural effect and you had absolutely no explanation for it, you could simply say that it's uncaused.
Wouldn't that sort of... Well, isn't causality sort of a starting point for science?
Sure, but there are some things that scientists say are uncaused, like the timing of radiation, that sort of quantum effects.
Oh, well, I don't necessarily agree with most scientists.
Don't necessarily agree with that.
Are you going back to Einstein and what he used to say before that priest set him straight about the Big Bang? What did he call that? He kind of had a miracle occurred in his special relativity before.
Yeah.
Before that priest.
It's a cosmological constant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And after that, he said it was his biggest blunder.
Yeah, but and now they're going back to it, which is kind of funny.
Are they?
Yeah, actually, I'm doing some research on that this summer with a professor of mine. Yeah, the cosmological constant, I would say, is back in full force, actually.
Isn't that doubly ironic?
Isn't there a book called Einstein's Biggest Blunder or something?
Yeah.
Aren't there a lot of books called a lot of things?
Well, that's a whole other discussion.
Well, there are a lot of crackpots that think Einstein was wrong.
No, I don't mean like it's a bad book.
No,
like Einstein's Greatest Blunder being like a good book.
Yeah, I think I've heard that. I think I've heard that, yeah.
I think I've heard of the book, too. I've never read it, though. The thing about scientists and physicists in particular, because that's what I know, is that while they are really good with numbers and calculations and theories, they're pretty bad with philosophy in general.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's perfectly understandable.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. And I wouldn't necessarily agree with what most physicists or how most physicists interpret philosophically the implications of quantum mechanics. Say.
You hear Hawking, he always talks about God, and it's like Einstein and Hawking both would use the word God in place of something that could have been worded better.
No, Stephen Hawking talks about God as the selection in...
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make, is that they just use the word God as a sort of help in their language rather than being philosophically consistent about it.
Right.
Yeah. If you want to read a philosophically consistent scientist's work, check out Bertrand Russell. He's got some good mathematics and philosophical books.
True.
So then, isn't it absurd to be a scientist and to be a Christian? Because as we were talking before, Christianity has a fundamental epistemic anxiety, which is how do you know if there's a God? How do you know anything?
Right.
If you're going to tell me the law of gravity is thus, and that means that the Earth goes around the Sun, but the Bible says that God can stop the orbit of the Earth.
Right.
How can you affirm the existence of immutable laws in the universe if at the same time you affirm the existence of a being which intervenes fundamentally in the universe and goes against those so-called laws?
Yeah, I think, like I said, and like you know, presumably, science and religion don't have much in common at all. And I think people who are scientists are not necessarily religious or non-religious. It has absolutely no bearing.
No,
and this
I,
is just,
I understand, but I'm just saying that there's a fundamental incompatibility.
Oh, sure, yeah, right. But again, that just shows my point that most physicists are not necessarily philosophically, I don't know what the right word is there, but
oriented, maybe. Well, people are mentalized, too. This is why people seem perfectly happy to take science and put it in one corner and issues of morality and put them in a completely different corner, even though both are ruled by causality to begin with.
Yeah, that is another thing that's really incredible to me, is how many scientists are liberal and conservative.
Yeah.
I think that they would have some understanding of the nature of truth and of the nature of working in group. I mean, science is inherently anarchic, is inherently based on a consensus. It's really based on values, and they don't seem to recognize that. I mean, science is the most successful enterprise of man, don't you agree?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's responsible for everything that we have today, so.
Then shouldn't we perhaps look at how it works as a good model to organize our enterprises?
Remember the dumb quote of the week? The guy said, science has to have religion because not everything you do in science is good, so religion has to be there to tell it to stop.
No. But what I'm saying is, the scientists understand how well science works, and yet they seem to have zero interest in looking at how science works and how it works organizationally and epistemically, and try to apply this to the world.
Yeah, well, the difference, I think, comes in from the fact that most sciences, like math and physics especially, are extremely straightforward. They're so simple. You think of something, you go out and check, bam, you're right or you're wrong. But when you come to something like morality, which of course is a science, you ask a scientist about it, and it's just so complicated. And it really doesn't have to be that complicated, but it's so apparently complicated. And from the way they were brought up, it can seem even more complicated. And it just sort of escapes them as being a science.
As if it's just too messy, you know, it's like art or something. We put art and morality and, you know, the humanity.
That's all part of culture.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
What I would say to mathematician and physicist is every science starts with premises or axioms. You have to start with an area of study, you have to start with your basic principles, and so I would explain to them the area of morality and the basic principles of morality, and explain to them how you deduce a certain value or virtue, etc.
Yeah, and I mean,
do you think that would be an approach that would help them understand?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, just because, I mean, most scientists are older. They've obviously thought about it a bit over the years, and just they've been brought up with it for so many years that I don't know how effective really any approach could be.
Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine to the truly open-minded scientist who hasn't already thought of it, that would help. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the problem is people have all this baggage.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
I just want to tell them, just forget about all that. Just look at the reality of it. Now, let's talk about human action. You know, just forget about all the religion and culture and, you know, parental authority and all that. Of course, you can't really forget it. That's kind of the problem.
Yep, exactly.
You just have to wipe slate and go back to basic principles.
Exactly.
And
maybe
that's
people
how
are
you should proceed
starting,
in anything.
People are starting from the premise that psychology and emotions are involved, and that they would necessarily change morality because of people's irrationality. And
people are starting from a morass of moral development with a lot of struggle, because I think that at a certain point, morality is a struggle, especially if you're a teenager. I think that most people are still moral teenagers.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
They see morality as being a struggle. Well, it's not a struggle at all. If you really, if you're rational about it, morality is not a struggle.
Yeah. I think what you're saying about going back to the basics is really evident in a lot of scientific fields. For instance, whenever a scientist or someone that I've been working with goes on to another topic, goes on to a new research project, you always go back to the basics, and you always start with what you learned as an undergrad, and then what you learned in graduate school, and then develop it further, but you never just dive right in. I mean, when a college kid starts out in on a physics path, they start with the most simple things, you know, that like velocity equals distance over time. It's just like stupid little simple basic stuff. You have to start there, because, if you don't, you'll just get bogged down. And you have to do the same thing when you're studying morality, too, so, yeah.
Exactly. If students in physics started with their preconceptions and beliefs on various issues such as gravity, the atom, etc., and then you put them right away into an advanced class, you're not going to get any results.
Yeah, I know a couple of kids, actually, who are not physics majors, who are just, you know, business or writing or whatever you have, what have you, who say, I don't believe in relativity, I'm Christian, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's like, if they take this general relativity class, they're not going to believe it any more than they did last semester. They're still going to think it's bunk.
You got to start earlier than that.
If you start them from, physics one.
That evolution series, those Christian kids had evolution in their Christian college, and they came away completely, a lot of them were questioning their religion altogether. So it is possible, but, they all had preconceived notions, no doubt.
I would say it's still pretty hard.
Well, when they sit down on the first day, and the first opening line from the professor is, so when you have length contraction and time dilation, they're just going to laugh their head off and, go out to the bathroom.
Time dilation? That's ridiculous. If you... a clock always turns at the same speed. I can't believe that stupid relativists believe in this nonsense.
We'll fight you out on that, though. I remember talking to roommates, a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, when I was showing the audio-visual model of how gravity works. And they had never heard it put that way. They just assumed gravity is like a force that pulls things. But they didn't know the actual mechanics of it. And I remember how cool it was with the handkerchief and the two marbles, and you stretch the handkerchief and you show the how gravity works, attracting objects to each other. And when I put it that way, like gravity is more like a reaction of bending of space-time, that kind of thing, they just were so angry at me. They said, well, you must be talking about some sort of scientist out there that's just like some sort of wacko. And, I'm like, Einstein.
He's such a wacko.
They hadn't had basic science in so long. They'd been out of high school. And
anyway, we have to go to the intermission.
Okay. Well, speaking of bodies and time and space fabric.
You mean space-time fabric.
Sorry. I've got two clips from the University of Virginia, A Moment of Science. They're talking about how planets are formed and why they are where they are. Just basic science, nothing to get all sarcastic about.
Okay, we'll be right back.
It's time for intermission, boys and girls. Take a deep breath. Relax.
Never Thought to Ask on this Moment of Science. It's time to open the Never Thought to Ask file. This is our file of science questions that, in all likelihood, you never thought to ask. And yet, you'll be puzzled trying to think of an answer. Ready, Yayo?
Ready, Don.
Where did the 9 planets that orbit our sun come from?
I never thought to ask that.
Of course not. Now, here's the answer. Way back before the solar system was formed, it was just a huge cloud of dust and gas floating in space. The natural attraction of gravity caused the dust to start whirling around a central lump. This lump collected more and more matter until it became so large that the force of its own gravity crushing down on its middle caused the center to ignite in a nuclear fire. Our sun was being born. The remaining cloud of dust was now spinning around the sun. But gravity was still in operation inside the dust cloud. Over time, the tiny flecks of cloud began to clump together once more, making marble-sized lumps, then basketball-sized lumps, all the way up to planet-sized lumps. Over a certain size, the biggest lumps had enough gravitational attraction on their own to mop up the remaining dust and gas by adding it to themselves. One of those lumps, still spinning around the sun, is where you are now standing. We called it Earth.
So why did the planets form exactly where they are in relation to the sun, instead of somewhere else?
Next time. Collision Course on this moment of science. Last time we explained where the planets came from. Originally, there was a huge cloud of dust and gas that gravity was causing to spin around its center, where a giant lump was being formed. That lump grew massive enough for its own crushing weight to cause it to burst into nuclear fire. That's the sun. Gravity then caused the remaining dust clouds spinning around the sun to fall into lumps as well. Those became the nine planets.
And then I asked, why are the planets where they are instead of somewhere else? Could, I don't know, Jupiter just as easily have been right next to the Earth?
No, because its strong gravity would have caused the Earth to be drawn into collision with it. What we call the Earth would have just become part of Jupiter.
So the planets can't be in just any orbit. They have to be far enough apart so that they don't hit each other.
So that they don't hit each other and aren't drawn into collision by gravity.
Wow. But how could planets figure that out?
They didn't figure anything out. It's just a matter of which orbits will cause the forming planets to hit each other at some point and which ones won't. Big lumps of matter in orbits that could cause them to collide with other lumps did in fact collide, thus forming bigger lumps. That's partly how the planets grew so large.
So after enough time, only the orbits that by coincidence don't intersect will be left over.
And that's what we have now.
Okay, intermission's over. The show must go on.
And we're back.
Yes.
So, you
had something to mention about this?
Yeah, so what Ali was talking about a minute ago with a sheet and marbles and gravity, I thought maybe some of you would be kind of lost on that. Because I know I would be if I didn't already know it pretty well. So I have a couple of videos, and I gave the URLs to Frank, so I guess he can send out the links on the mailing list. Just check them out. They're really cool. There's a couple of things going on, but you want to watch, there's like a green piece of paper, sort of, that's like a grid, and that's sort of the sheet Ali was talking about, and you can imagine stuff rolling around on there, and that's, essentially, that's how gravity works. Stuff rolls around on that green grid, which is space itself. But you'll have to watch it to see what I mean. So
you could say it's like a cloth.
A fabric,
that
exactly.
Some elasticity to it.
Right.
You know,
The fabric is space time.
The fabric is space time. Yeah.
Exactly.
And the mass, the say planet, which is represented by a marble, is actually changing the fabric, obviously.
Right.
Even no matter how tight you pull it, well, you know, it's a cloth, so it's going to make an indentation wherever it is. And
right, and then you can imagine things rolling
marble,
around.
When you roll that second marble towards the first marble, it's going to do something interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you have a fleet of starships that go at warp speed in the same area, you can create a tear in space-time.
Yeah,
that's from Star Trek.
I don't think that's been confirmed experimentally.
It's probably just some green wackos that came up in there. Anyway, so now we're going to talk about the arguments from science. Because people, this is another thing, a lot of people say, you can't disprove God in science, because science, we can't observe God. That's correct. However, what we can do is we can observe things that should be if God existed,
Well, there's claims made about God that you can, I mean,
exactly.
Claims made about what God does. And if we observe that those things are not done by, are done by something else.
That's one aspect of it, but there are many things in nature that we can observe and see. Well, that doesn't jive. It doesn't jive. So you got an argument. You got at least good evidence in that. And the first thing is Occam's razor. Well, we've got all these scientific explanations. Now, obviously, Ed, we're not saying that science has already found everything.
Right.
I mean, that would be ridiculous. However, what we do observe is that when we apply science, scientific method, to natural phenomena, we are eventually able to explain them. And so so far we've done a lot of explaining, and it works. So this gives us a good doubt for the existence of God. That gives us a pretty good probability right there.
Yeah, I would say so, sure.
That God doesn't exist, because if God exists, as I said, we should have epistemic anxiety about nature. We certainly should not find laws. We should not find theories, principles.
We should be able to predict things.
Well, we do. We are able to predict things, which seems to indicate that the universe is self-contained. Right?
Right. Sure.
So it's pretty good evidence. I wouldn't say it's conclusive. Of course, like you said, if we knew everything about the universe, we could.
Yeah. I mean, like when a scientist goes on it and finds something new, they don't expect it to turn out to be a miracle. They expect
right.
it to turn out to be some sort of natural phenomenon.
The point is that so far we've used a method that assumes naturalism, and so far it's working. That's,
right.
that's the basic point.
Right.
The second argument is the Big Bang cosmological argument for God's non-existence. The argument is basically that the state of the singularity of the Big Bang was not ruled by laws of physics as we know them today. And that there was no guarantee that the universe would, the Big Bang singularity would emit a configuration of particles that would evolve into the kind of universe that theism predicts. Now, theism, maybe not all forms of theism, but I would say most, say that God created the universe in order to have life in it, to have organisms like himself, right?
Okay.
I don't know if you guys agree on that.
Well, apparently that's what he did in the Bible, so.
So that's the argument, basically. The argument is that God, obviously the Big Bang was not ensured of producing the kind of universe that would have life in it. And if God existed, then he would have created states of the universe that would ensure the existence of life eventually. So that's the general line of the...
My favorite argument to this from Ray Comfort is, were you there? Figure since it's scientific, then you have to observe it. So, you know, of course...
Little does he know, they do observe it.
Of course they do. You know, Hubble, you know, radiation. Yeah, it's hard to explain that, though, to an insane Christian.
Yeah, that's true. It's hard to explain that to anyone, really.
Now, there's another argument which Ed is more habilitated to explain than I am, which is called the argument from quantum physics. Or
yeah.
Why don't you explain this briefly?
Yeah, the argument from quantum physics. So, so in quantum mechanics, basically the idea is that if something is in a quantum state, then it's in what's called the superposition of different states. So what that means is, instead of something pointing up or down, say, it points a little bit up and a little bit down, but really it's just like a probability that it's pointing up and a probability that it's pointing down. So it's like a superposition of two states. You don't know for sure if it's pointing up or down, but it's one or the other with a certain probability. So the problem is that God is omniscient. He knows everything. So God knows whether or not this quantum object is pointing up or down. He knows if it's pointing up, he knows if it's pointing down. 100%.
The cat is dead.
Right, exactly. Schrodinger's cat. He knows when the cat's dead. And the problem is that if God is omniscient, then these quantum superpositions should be what we call collapsed. In other words, it goes to 100% chance that it's pointing up or 100% chance that it's pointing down from a probability that it's a little bit of both.
So if a God existed, we would see no, we would have no superpositions at all.
Right.
We would just observe
facts, 100%.
Electrons being up or down.
Right, exactly. There would just be fact, unrefutable, it points up or it points down, no in between.
Right.
We do. In fact, you can sort of prepare a mixture of particle soup in any state that you want. It can be up and down and left and right, and you can actually go out and make it. So, there certainly are non-collapsed superpositions that are non-trivial.
Therefore,
gods cannot exist. At least omniscient gods cannot exist. So.
Right. Is there a way maybe to formulate? I'm just thinking about a counter here. Is there a way to maybe formulate a god that does not directly know everything about the universe?
Well, I know that a lot of Christians, or at least, well, some Christians say that, you know, God started the universe and let it go, but he doesn't know everything about it.
Well, that's not Christian, though. That's
deism.
Well, I guess it depends on who you talk to. Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
however, deism is not acceptable for a physicist or for an astrophysicist.
Why?
If you say that God started the universe, you're not doing science anymore.
Right.
But
exactly.
The beginning of the universe is part of your area, even though we're not really able to study it right now. It's still part of your area of science. You can't say God did it.
Well, we can study it fairly well, but...
Poor Lisa's
sense. All I'm saying is it's not a scientific way of... I don't think you can be a scientist
right.
And say that something within... It's like if you study evolution, but then you talk about human evolution, you say, oh, well, God did that. I can't explain how the brain got so big and the body was and blah, blah, blah. So I'm just going to give up and say God did it. You know,
what's interesting about the Big Bang, we were talking about earlier that even scientists carry a lot of baggage with them. What's really interesting is a lot of physicists sort of forget their own rules when they talk about that kind of stuff, because any physicist will tell you that energy is always conserved.
Right.
But as soon as it comes to the Big Bang, they're going through this thing about creation. And of course, the concept is nonsense. It's nonsense. But they have all this baggage with them, and from where they're from, creation is a perfectly acceptable term and concept. And of course, then the law of conservation of energy does not hold. So
the problem is that they use the word creation in a Christian sense, not in the normal sense.
Right.
Because
exactly.
In the normal sense, creation just means recombination of units in order to form new wholes, which would be a good description for the Big Bang.
Sure. Yeah. Of course. I mean, you know, you create a table out of wood, but
right. It's a creation of matter itself, as we know it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What about, there's another basic fact of physics which goes against God belief, that's the inseparability of space and time. And the basic problem in that is that people say that God acts beyond space. But...
The concept is kind of new
that
they're
true.
Using because of what we know.
Actions require time. So if time and space are directly are inseparable, then there can be no such thing as a divine action. So do you agree? I'm sure you agree, Ed, that space and time are inseparable.
Oh yeah, sure. In a lot of advanced physics problems, you actually treat time and space exactly the same way. You label them the same, you don't change anything about them. You just treat them exactly the same. There's absolutely no difference between them, and you get true results from those problems.
And there's this idea of a God acting outside of the universe is sort of a thing where you believe that space and time are completely separate. You understand what I mean?
Right, well, I hear a lot of times that God acts outside of time. You know, he's atemporal.
Right, exactly. The way to get out of this is to say that God is atemporal. However, that only creates more problems, especially in regards to how an atemporal God can suddenly become temporal to create the universe.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of problems going on there.
It just piles up more problems.
Well, it's like they've, since we've learned what we've learned about physics and such, religion has created this sort of, you know, bewitched TV series version of reality where there's this other place.
No, I would say that it's a more and more abstracted God.
Well, definitely, but, I mean, there's this other place where they probably would label it a dimension, like, you know, the fifth dimension, Aquarius, you know, where God goes or comes from, where we can't see him and nobody can touch him. He can do his stuff and then come back, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And
that's where heaven is.
Right.
Place.
I thought heaven was like above the clouds, and it was like, you know, 100 miles on the side or something.
Yeah, it was simply at the top of the trees because no one had ever been there. And there were, in fact, the medieval woodcuts had birds flying around up there where God was sitting in his throne, just at the tops of the trees because they hadn't invented balloons yet. And, you know, once the balloons came in, you know, so much for the tops of the trees. But I'm sure, that, I mean, there are people who lived in high mountains that would get that kind of perspective. They certainly, in Tibet, wouldn't have the same kind of God living at the tops of the trees.
Yeah, but they're all Buddhists anyway. So who cares about them, right?
Who cares about them? Even though they saw where God was supposed to have lived and didn't see anything. But yeah, we talk about this a lot. God moved several times. The more we learn about science, the more we learn about what's up, until God finally stopped being able to go up any farther.
Mm-hmm.
They have to now make God go out.
Yeah, it's funny though. Well, for some people, they don't even need to make God go out yet, because some people I've talked to actually don't think we've been in outer space and still think God lives in outer space. So,
so can you see God with a telescope?
Well, I guess he lives on the dark side of the moon or something.
So. Outer space. We've got these gigantic, well, Hubble's in space, but you
know. How about Jehovah's Witnesses?
What about Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, they used to believe that Jesus lived in the Pleiades.
Well, that's true, right.
Which
Pleiades? I mean, it's not like they're next door to each other.
Isn't there one of those religions that believe that you can rule a planet?
Mormons? That's Mormons. I don't know. I'm not really educated enough about Mormonism, about Planet Kolob, whether it's accurate or if it's like conservative Christians made up this idea.
Your own planet.
You're supposed to have your harem of wives and shit. Okay. I don't know where Kolob is, though. That's like where God's supposed to live.
Okay.
Planet Kolob, eh?
Yeah, Kolob. Kolob.
I'm going to look that up.
We have to look that up again.
Yeah.
Then there's the argument from evolution. This is an argument based on the fact that evolution is the only process we know that can cause the existence of intelligence. And, of course, most religious people say that God is a being, that God has some intelligence. If you say that God is just a process or a physical law, then there's really no point in talking, right? But God is supposed to be intelligent, so how did this intelligence occur? They say that God is uncaused, but we've never seen intelligence come uncaused. Never, as far as I know. And I know that Ed would probably argue that we have never seen it. But it doesn't matter anyway, because either way, you know, no intelligence has ever come uncaused. Intelligence is always caused by a process of evolution, because that's the only natural way there is to have some such complexity. Well, I mean, there are other processes that do make complexity, but evolution is really the best way we have to produce complexity. And so did God evolve? God could not have evolved.
I'm sorry, my brain is down below. I can't help but remember what Marge Simpson said to show how much she understood about evolution, and she said, "I can't wait to find out what evolution makes next. A bird with a people face, or a bear that wears pants." I knew Marge couldn't possibly have understood evolution, even after reading The Origin of Species.
Exactly.
A bear who wears pants.
See what evolution will make next. See, evolution is for God now. Uh-oh.
The time is for God.
Right. So the question arises, where does God's intelligence come from?
Right.
So as I see, there's only two ways. Either to say that God does not have intelligence, which is to say that God is just a natural process, or an object floating around in some kind of dimension, which means that there's no point in worshiping.
Do they float in the other dimension?
I'm just assuming they do. Isn't that usually how things go in other dimensions?
Yeah, things like the float.
You float and stuff.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
In The Simpsons, there's that grid.
Yeah, and Homer floats.
He kind of jumps like he's on the moon. That's the amazing world of the third dimension.
Anyway, we only have a minute left, and we had other arguments, but I guess we're gonna have to stop here.
Crap.
So, by the way, you can check these and many other arguments at strongatheism.net, which is, I have a big list of all the ideological arguments there are out there in the literature, on the internet, etc.
Yeah, just go into the atheology section in the library, and the ones we've been reading were under the scientific incoherency apologetics section, but...
I made a specific section for the scientific arguments, because there are so many, and people don't even know that. I mean, I think it's cool to be able to get that word out. And that's the end of the show. So why don't you go ahead and give our coordinates.
Our website is hellboundalley.com. And our email address is ally@hellboundalley.com, ALLEEE.
You know, that's so true. And
thanks to our listeners who send us the answer to what brass tacks means. And
we will read that on the live show tomorrow. Talking about the live show tomorrow, we're going to have two guests on the live show. We're going to have a greeny wacko who's going to explain to us why we're wrong about vegetarianism. And we're going to have an atheist guest to talk to us about foxholes and why
they're so great.
Are some atheists in them, or why they're so great or so bad, I don't know yet. And our show next week is supposed to be with Per Bylund again, but I think we might have to cancel that. Well, you'll see on our archives next week.
We'll let you guys know what's going on.
Goodbye, everyone.
We'll see you next week.
Well, of course, even scientific facts are not perfectly exact, but they are as exact as it is humanly possible to make them at the time.
It's a scientific fact, it has to be correct, it has to be exact, because it is a science.